I want to talk today about the efficient markets hypothesis. Let me just first say, last lecture was about insurance. And I was telling you about the theory of insurance and how it's evolved over the years and how it's produced some real benefits. Is that better? It says mic volume. Did that go up? Okay. So I wanted to just tie this in, the advantages of insurance that we have to some big events that occurred. And that will, I think, point out the strengths and weaknesses of our institutions. So we had a terrible hurricane a couple of years ago in Los Angeles. Hurricane Katrina damaged the city of, I'm sorry, did I say Los Angeles? You have to stop me when I say things that are obviously wrong. My mind lapses sometimes. New Orleans. And Los Angeles doesn't have to worry about hurricanes, as far as I know, unless there's some major change. In New Orleans, there was a Hurricane Katrina. It broke the levees that were surrounding the city and caused a flooding of the city. What saved the people of the city, mostly? I would say it's actually the insurance institutions, because the city was heavily damaged, but homes were generally insured. There was some conflicts that happened when this huge disaster came. Some people had wind insurance, and some people had flood insurance. It became difficult whether this was a wind or a flood problem, right? Because the wind caused the flood. So if you had only wind insurance, are you covered? So there was a lot of bickering and arguments afterwards. But I think it worked out well. There were surveys of customer satisfaction after the event. And I think generally people were happy with their insurance companies. Of course, there were some that were not, who may have found out that they weren't covered. But on the whole, the experience worked well. So the other thing I wanted to say about the last lecture is that as financial progress moves on, the distinction between insurance and other forms of risk management may get blurred. And one very interesting thing that's been happening is that we are starting to see development of another institution called a catastrophe bond, which is another way that people have of protecting themselves against catastrophes, and it's not insurance. So a catastrophe bond is a bond that the issuer doesn't have to pay off if there's a catastrophe. All right, so you can have hurricane. The city of New Orleans could raise money with catastrophe bonds that they have to pay back if there's no hurricane, but they don't have to pay back if there is a hurricane. Or it could be some mixture. They'd pay back part of it if there is a hurricane. That's like insurance, isn't it? But it doesn't operate through an insurance company. It operates through the securities market. So a good example of that is a couple of years ago, the government of Mexico issued catastrophe bonds against earthquakes. Mexico City was hit by a terrible earthquake about 20 years ago, and it's vulnerable to being hit again. So what does Mexico do about this? Mexico could wait until there is a hurricane and hope that there's some international relief effort. But you know, that's not a very good way to proceed. We want to arrange it in advance. So what Mexico did is issue cat bonds that have to be repaid in the absence of a hurricane and have a lower repayment if there is. I'm sorry, a hurricane. I'm not in my best form today. Earthquake. Mexico City does not have to worry about hurricanes either. Every area is different, and they have their own individual characteristics. So right now, the insurance industry is a bit challenged because, in terms of some risks, because the risks seem to be changing through time. And notably, it looks like hurricane risk is increasing. And so people who are insured in, it seems to be increasing because of global warming, although I don't know if all scientists are agreed on that. But if you live in a coastal area of Florida, it does appear that your risk is increasing through time. So insurance companies want to raise your rates. And this is a huge issue down in Florida. Well, the government has kind of taken over for the time being insurance in Florida because we have problems. People are having problems paying the increased insurance premium. I don't think we've figured out finally how insurance will ultimately look in a matter of years. But I think that the important thing is that it's protecting us against already, maybe imperfectly, but it's already protecting us against some of our worst fears, like hurricanes and earthquakes. And that I think the system is evolving and we're getting new developments like cat bonds that are changing the way we're doing things. And in the future, I think these will develop more and make us even better able to handle catastrophe risks. Anyway, that's the last lecture. Today I wanted to talk about, back to securities markets, or actually more general, asset markets. And I want to talk today about the efficient markets hypothesis, which is a very important intellectual construct that has guided a lot of theory in finance. I want to talk first about the history of the hypothesis. I haven't defined it yet for you, but maybe you already have heard of this. But history of the hypothesis and the arguments for it, and then the arguments against it. And I want to talk about technical analysis and empirical evidence in the literature about technical analysis and other schools of thought that doubt market efficiency. Talk somewhat about behavioral economics. And then finally, we have a homework assignment. Actually, it's coming up. I'll start talking about it now. So it would be an assignment for you to try to forecast the stock market using statistical methods. So you don't have to look at the screen yet. It just blinked off. I'll come back to that. What is the efficient markets hypothesis? The term actually is of fairly recent origin, that is a few decades ago. But the idea goes back much further. The idea is that in asset markets that have good regulations and market makers and developed markets that have a lot of depth and liquidity. In these markets, the prices that you see are perfect indicators of true value. In other words, efficient markets says that the market efficiently incorporates all information and the prices are like the best information about the value of something. In other words, efficient markets hypothesis tells you trust markets. Don't trust people, trust markets. I've been trying to find out who said that first. The earliest statement of the efficient markets hypothesis, although it doesn't call it the efficient markets hypothesis, the earliest statement that I could find comes from a book written in 1889 by George Gibson, and it's called The Stock Exchanges of London, Paris, and New York. I quote him. He said, "When shares become publicly known in an open market, the value which they acquire there may be regarded as the judgment of the best intelligence concerning them. So I was kind of interested to see this book. I found it in the Mudd Library, actually, by accident, looking through old stock market books. The book had some interesting observations. One observation which took my interest was that he points out that in this modern electronic age, information speeds around the globe at the speed of electricity, or the speed of light. When I first read that, I thought from it, wait a minute, 1889? That sounds like 1989 or something. Are we going to interrupt the... Uh-huh. Just a moment. We found the microphone. Why didn't one of you... It was right there?
Sorry about that. There you go.
Now I'm freed from my from my tether. In 1889, they had already invented the telegraph. In fact, that goes back decades earlier. And the telephone was starting to appear. And so it really was true that information would speed around the globe. And so information that became publicly known would be entered into market price almost immediately. And so the conclusion that Gibson had was that there's no hope in trying to beat the price or beat the market, because the price already has all of the information in it. Let me elaborate on that theme a little bit. Actually, it goes back before telegraph. There is a famous story of Mr. Reuters, who had an information service before the telegraph was invented. And he wanted to help his clients get the information first so that they could trade on it. And he had the idea of using what you call carrier pigeons. What you do is you get these birds and you raise them. You know what I'm talking about, right? You raise them in one place, and then they're going to want to go back there. So then you take them away in a cage to another city. And when you need to get a message across, you tie the message to the pigeon's foot and release it, and then it will fly back. And it will beat any other method of message transmission. Incidentally, Reuters Information Service is still in business today. And now they use computers the way everyone else does. But the whole principle precedes the invention of computers. The idea is that the only way you can beat the market is to get information that nobody else has. And the way it works today is that we can't actually improve on the speed from 1889, right? Because they were already going at virtually the speed of light with their information. But we can improve on the our access to it. So now many people have beepers or something like this in their pocket that wakes up and tells them when news is announced. So what happens when there's news about a stock? So let's say it's a drug company that just makes an announcement that it has a new drug, let's say, good news, or it has gotten FDA approval to market some new drug. Well, it would put that out over the network of information, and some people would have their things beep on them and alert them immediately. There are analysts who try to keep up with news about stocks. And so these analysts then would jump to action when they hear that news like that. That's because they know that markets move really fast information to important new information. And they've got to be there first. So what happens when the drug company announces that they have some news, important news? Well, the guys who are with their beepers immediately spring to action and try to figure out what the news is. And within seconds, they're trading. Because you know, you've got to be there first. Otherwise, you can't benefit from the news. So what happens? They say they've announced, they've got approval for this new drug. And then they maybe do a quick call to their drug company expert and say, quick, how much should I change the valuation of this stock? And the guy will give a quick guess, this is now 20 seconds after the announcement. And then immediately you place a big trade for 1 million shares or plus or minus. And then the guy calls back 30 seconds later and says, oh, no, I wasn't exactly right on that. I've had 30 more seconds to think about this. So let me change it again. So over the next few minutes, the price, a lot of people are trading like that, so the price is jumping around rapidly. Then after maybe 5 minutes, these people have had time to assimilate it and think about it and check their thinking, and the price starts to settle down. Maybe I'm exaggerating how fast it settles down. Maybe an hour later, you have a committee meeting, and the experts are arguing about what this really means and trying to assimilate other information and coordinate with it. But after 2 hours, it's starting to really settle down. So suppose you then, the next day, read in the Wall Street Journal about this new announcement. Do you think you have any chance of beating the market by trading on it? I mean, you're like 24 hours late. But I hear people tell me, I read in Business Week that there's a new announcement, so I'm thinking of buying. And I say, well, Business Week, that information is probably a week old. Even other people will talk about trading on information that's years old. And so you kind of think that maybe these people are naive. You know, first of all, you're not a drug company expert or whatever it is that's needed. Secondly, you don't know the math or whatever. You don't know how to calculate present values, probably. And then thirdly, you're a month late. And so you get the impression that a lot of people shouldn't be trying to beat the market. And that you might say to a first approximation, the market has it all right. And so don't even try. So the efficient markets hypothesis is a hypothesis that one should respect financial markets very much. So your textbook by Fabozzi et al. Mentions, I looked up in the index to see what they say about efficient markets hypothesis. They define it. I'm quoting the textbook, Fabozzi, publicly available relevant information about the issuers will lead to correct pricing of freely traded securities in properly functioning markets. That's their definition of the efficient markets hypothesis. They didn't say it was right. They just said that's the hypothesis. What Fabozzi et al. Said is that the hypothesis has informed a lot of regulation. The Securities and Exchange Commission and other agencies that regulate financial markets have shown some faith in the efficient markets hypothesis. And therefore, they feel that their primary mission is to regulate the flow of information, to make sure that it's an even playing field so that everyone has access to information at the same time. So, for example, the Securities and Exchange Commission requires that when a corporation publishes information that's relevant to the value of their stock, they have to put it out to everyone at once. Well, there's rules about what that means. But typically, they'll have a webcast or something like that, and it's announced in advance, so everyone who is really interested can listen in. But I don't find a whole lot of enthusiasm in the Fabozzi book for the efficient markets hypothesis. And maybe that's because it's not exactly right, which is my view. It's a half-truth, and I'll come back to that. I wanted to quote another best-selling textbook, not your own, but there's another textbook, Brealey and Myers, which is a textbook of corporate finance. And they are much more enthusiastic about efficient markets hypothesis. At the end of their textbook, they have a concluding chapter. And the concluding chapter is built around what they call the seven most important ideas in finance. And one of those seven ideas to them is efficient markets. They don't call it a hypothesis. They just say efficient markets, which they define as the theory that, I'm quoting them, security prices accurately reflect available information and respond rapidly to new information as soon as it becomes available. Then they have a little qualifier. I think this is interesting. They say, don't misunderstand the efficient market idea. It doesn't say that there are no taxes or costs. It doesn't say that there aren't some clever people and some stupid ones. It merely implies that competition in capital markets is very tough. There are no money machines, and security prices reflect the true underlying value of assets. Well, that's a pretty enthusiastic endorsement of efficient markets. I said I have some doubts about it. I guess I guess what I don't like is their concluding statement: security prices reflect the true underlying value of assets. I don't think that's really true. But I guess I agree, it's tough to make money reliably and quickly in financial markets. And so if that's what efficient markets means, they're right. But you know, efficient markets is not so easy to define. We can go back to, the term really goes back to 1967. And it was Professor Harry Roberts at University of Chicago who defined three different efficient markets hypotheses. There's the weak form, the semi-strong form, and then the strong form. The weak form, these differ only in terms of the amount of information that is assumed to be efficiently incorporated into prices. The weak form says that info of past prices is already incorporated into price. So, but only past prices. What it means only is that you can't predict stock prices by noting that, say, if it goes up today, it'll probably go up tomorrow, or if it goes up today, it'll probably go down tomorrow. That would be relying only on past prices. And so Harry Roberts felt most confident that this form of the hypothesis was good. So he called it the weak form. It's the least criticizable form of efficient markets. Semi-strong form says that market prices incorporate all public information. Anything that's known to the public is already incorporated into the price, so don't bother to trade on it. The strong form says all information, whether public or not, is incorporated into price. This is a really strong, it's the least likely to be true, because every time you increase the information set, what strong form says is that no information is private, really. It all gets out into price. Companies keep secrets, and so that's not public information. The Securities and Exchange Commission insists that companies keep secrets because they have to disseminate information in an orderly way, and so there has to be a secret until a certain hour in which it's announced to everybody. But the strong form efficient markets hypothesis is cynical about that and says, you know, nobody keeps secrets, it all leaks out. I think that when we refer to the efficient markets hypothesis, it's the semi-strong form that we're usually referring to, because the strong form is a bit strong. And okay, so the definitions of efficient markets that I gave you are intuitive but not very precise, because then you have to ask, well, what does it mean to say that price incorporates all information? What does it mean to incorporate information? Unfortunately, there's not one answer to that question. I'm going to give the simplest answer. What does efficient markets mean? This is the simplest version, but it's often the one that's often the one that is referred to most, and that is that price is the expected value, the expected present value of future dividends paid on the stock. Okay, the efficient markets hypothesis says the true value of a stock comes from the dividends that it pays. That's a cash flow that is valued by the market, and the market values it as the present value of the optimally forecasted future dividends. Okay, so And the theory that's most often referred to is the simple, I've already talked in the second lecture about present value formulas. We had a growing perpetuity model. Remember that I said that the present value, the present discounted value of a growing perpetuity that pays an amount d, if it pays, if the payant is d times e to the gt, or d sub 0 e to the gt is the dividend, so it's growing at rate lowercase g there, then the formula we had for the present value was d over r minus g. Remember that? This assumes, of course, that the growth rate of dividends has to be less than the discount rate r. So the simplest version of the efficient markets hypothesis says price is equal to the dividend all over the discount rate minus the growth rate of dividends, where g, the growth rate of dividends, is an optimally forecasted growth rate of dividend. And so that gives us a model for the price. Another way of writing more generally is, if I don't assume the constant growth rate of dividends, is to write just a present value formula. It's another less strong form of writing down the efficient markets hypothesis, because it doesn't say how dividends are thought to grow. But you can write the price is equal to the summation of the expectation at time t of dividends at time t plus k all over 1 plus r to the kth power k equals 1 to infinity. This is another incarnate. That's just the present value formula. I have the price, this should be the expectation at time t. The price at time t is the expectation of the dividend at time t plus k discounted by a discount factor r. And that's just the present value formula, where I've substituted an expectation for the future dividend. So that's the efficient markets theory in this incarnation. Now, there's other ways to envision the efficient markets, what it means. But let's consider this simple story. What this means, then, is that price is a forecast of future dividends to be paid on the stock. This would be of the present value of future dividends to be paid on the stock. And this means, then, that price relative to dividend is related to expected future growth rates of dividends. If you expect dividends to grow a lot, if G is high, then price will be high relative to dividend, because this is subtracted off the denominator. It makes the denominator smaller, and it makes the price higher. On the other hand, if you expect dividends to do poorly in the future, then price will be low relative to dividends. That's what the efficient markets hypothesis would say. I would give you an example of that. I talked last year about a company that I read in Business Week, so this is a year-old story in Business Week. There was a company called First Fed Financial, which was a company that issues mortgages. And already, this was in January of 2007. Actually, the Business Week story was in December of 2006, but I was still reacting to it a year ago, in January of 2007. Business Week story, this is First Fed Financial. Was referring to the fact that the price dividend ratio, actually they talked about price earnings ratio, But the price earnings ratio for this company was very low. It was only 8.5 in December 2006. That's 8.5, and write that very clearly. Typically, price earnings ratios of companies are very high, much higher than that, typically like 15. So the price of First Fed Financial relative to its earnings was very low. And so some people might be inclined to think, well, that looks cheap. I can buy, by buying First Fed Financial, I can buy the stock at a low price relative to its earnings. But if you believe in efficient markets, you wouldn't think that this is any reason to buy the company. Because efficient markets would say that if the price is low relative to either dividends or earnings, it must mean that people think that bad things are going to come to the dividends or earnings. In other words, the First Fed Financial has a low expected growth rate of dividends in the future. And so I was interested in this particular story because Business Week wrote an article about them and noted the low price earnings ratio and said, what does this mean? And what Business Week presented a year ago was an argument why G was likely to be low. Yes?
How would the efficient market theory predict price movements in stock like Berkshire Hathaway, which has gone probably will not pay dividends?
Yes, if they don't pay dividends, you can't use this formula. And I'm not sure what the dividends were of First Fed Financial. I only know the price earnings ratio at that time. But you're right. You cannot use this formula if they're not paying a dividend today, because this formula, I erased it, but it was up here, assumes that dividends are following a growth path. And if they're not paying a dividend, then that we're very clearly, that's not an appropriate assumption. Yeah. Right. So for Berkshire, incidentally, if you know, Berkshire Hathaway is the company that Warren Buffett owns, and it's a very famous company because it's done extremely well, and Warren Buffett is regarded as by many people as a financial genius. But if Berkshire Hathaway is not paying a dividend, we have to revert to this formula. So the efficient market theory would say, well, they're going to pay a dividend eventually, and so the price reflects these future terms. If you spell this out, this is the expected dividend next year plus the dividend in 2 years divided by 1 plus r squared plus the expected dividend in 3 years divided by 1 plus r cubed, etc. So this theory would say that the dividend, that Berkshire Hathaway has value only because they investors expect them to pay dividends in the future. And that sounds right, because if Berkshire Hathaway is never going to pay dividends, why would you hold it? You might say, I'll hold it because I could sell to someone else at a higher price. But then you say, well, why would anyone else buy it? Look, if they're never going to pay a dividend, what good is it? It's just a piece of paper, right? Unless I can sell to a greater fool. But anyone who buys it would be buying it either on the assumption that there's some greater fool coming, or they would be a fool themselves. So this theory says that the value, if Warren Buffett, of course he can't even say this, but let's somehow say the company could say, we will never pay a dividend. This company is going to give it away to charity someday, and you won't get a penny as a stockholder. Well, if that happened, the price should be zero. It would convert into a nonprofit like Yale University. So what's the price of a share in Yale University? I mean, it's undefined. I guess it's zero, right? Because Yale is not paying. I'll write a piece of paper for you and say, this is a share on my authority. This is a share in Yale University. And it might just as well be that, because it also says in my fine print, you will never get a dividend on this. So what's the point, right? Incidentally, Microsoft for many years never paid a dividend. It's often common for young companies not to pay dividends, but they did start paying a dividend. And the whole theory, efficient markets theory, says that that's what people are looking for. So that's why the value of a company is related to its activities. Otherwise, if the company never paid a dividend, then what would you care what the company is doing? You only care about it because someday they're going to give you money. A lot of investors forget that. That's a very naive thing, attitude. They think that somehow stocks generate capital gains, prices go up. But you have to realize, and efficient markets theory is saying this, that prices only go up because there's new information about future dividends. Okay. So First Financial, anyway, this is an efficient market story. First Financial had a low PE, and so people were wondering, is this a bargain? This is a cheap stock. PE means price earnings ratio. The Business Week article pointed out that 40% of First Federal had been sold short. 40% of their stock had been sold short. This is a very high level of short interest. Do you know what that means? That means a lot of investors said, I don't like First Fed Financial. I don't want to invest in it. Worse than that, I want to go and short them. So that means you borrow shares and sell them and hope that the price goes down. When you have 40% of the shares sold short, that means that there's a lot of people who didn't believe in First Fed Financial. So Business Week, in its article, pointed out that this First Fed Financial was a small mortgage lender. This is before the mortgage crisis that we're in started in Santa Monica, California. And that it was particularly innovative, in a sense, in its lending. Notably, 80%, according to the Business Week article, 80% of the mortgages it's issued were no-doc mortgages. And do you know the no-doc mortgage? It's something that appeared recently in the housing frenzy. A no-doc mortgage is a mortgage where you walk in and say, I want to borrow money to buy this house. And the company says, fine, we'll give you a mortgage. We won't even ask you to have your employer send a letter saying that you have a job. We won't even ask you to prove that you own anything or have. We'll just give you the mortgage. That's considered by many people risky behavior, but it was done during the housing boom. Also, they issued an unusually high proportion of what are called option arms. These are mortgages that are adjustable rate, but also the person doesn't have to pay the full payment every time. You have the option of paying, and if you don't want to pay, you can delay it for a while. And these are also controversial because it thought they would attract borrowers who were unreliable. Borrowers who thought that they could afford the house because they didn't have to pay now. But of course, it's all going to come later, and then they might default. So Business Week thought that the low price earnings ratio was because the market expected earnings to go down and dividends to go down. So a year later, that is this morning, I wanted to see what First Fed Financial is doing. And actually, it's still in business. Everything's all right. It has positive earnings. But its price, the price was $70 in the beginning of 2007. And now it's down to about $40, 2008. So this is a testimony to efficient markets. The market was expecting the price-earnings ratio. They gave it a low PE because they were worried about, they had information that there was something going badly in this company. And indeed, they were right. It's not as bad as you might have thought with the Business Week story, but it is bad. So I guess the lesson, are you following what I'm talking? So what happened was they did get into trouble. The low PE was indeed a forecaster of bad performance later. Now, I guess this isn't exactly efficient markets wouldn't. In this case, the people who sold First Fed Financial short made a lot of money when the price went down so much. That's not really consistent with efficient markets, because it makes it sound like, as a matter of fact, I could have, reading the Business Week article at the beginning of 2007, I could have called my broker, and I could have told my broker, short, please, I want to short First Fed Financial, and I could have done that, and it looks like I'd have made a lot of money, right, by shorting it, because the price went down a lot. Efficient markets theory would have to say that was an anomaly, that was just good luck. Those people who shorted First Fed Financial did make a lot of money, but hey, they were just lucky this time. In other words, efficient markets theory would say that the price was already down as far as it was, you know, basically as far as it would go in 2007, and that earnings would fall and dividends would fall later, and that would explain why the price was low. But it wouldn't allow you to predict the price. So this anomaly, the fact that it worked out so well is really not to short investors, is really not testimony to efficient markets. So efficient market, you know, in some sense I think I'm sympathetic to efficient market. We have to be sympathetic to some extent. If I were trying, you know, I actually did not short First Fed Financial when I read this last year, and it was because I guess I had my doubt, you know, I had my feeling. You read a Business Week article, you know, and it's everyone in the world knows it now, that a lot of people doubt First Fed Financial. So if I come in late as a short seller, am I going to do well? You know, I start to doubt it myself because there's so many people looking at it and so many people who are more knowledgeable about First Fed Financial than I am. So, you know, maybe I won't try shorting it. And that's what efficient markets is all about. The efficient markets theory became very popular in finance around 1970, and it became a prominent theory in finance. It has a particular incarnation that I wanted to emphasize called random walk. And so the random walk theory, which follows loosely from this formula, though I have to qualify it, but let me talk about random walk as a theory in itself. The random walk theory says that under efficient markets, stock prices and other speculative asset prices are random walks. And that term goes back to Carl Pearson in an article in Nature in 1905. So this idea is about 100 years old. And what Pearson wrote about was, the example he gave was a drunk. Imagine a person who is so drunk that every step that person takes is random and independent of the preceding step, okay? And so suppose we, this is 1905 story, suppose we had a lamppost and we had a drunk standing at the lamppost. I've drawn a picture. That's a lamppost and that's a drunk. This person is so intoxicated that steps are completely random. And your object is to predict where will this person be in 1 minute, in 10 minutes, and 20 minutes. Okay? Well, Pearson wrote about this and said that the optimal prediction is to assume that the person in 10 minutes, the best forecast is the person will be here. In 20 minutes, what's the best forecast? Person will be here. Of course, they probably won't because they're randomly staggering around. But the point is that if it's a true random walk, there's no bias. It's equally likely to go this way or this way. The most likely place for the person is right where that person is now. And so Pearson and other people following him thought that speculative prices are like that. That sounds like the markets are crazy. They're drunk, but they're not drunk. It's because they respond only to new information. And so new information is by its essence unforecastable. And so it has to look like the market is driven by a drunk when in fact it's very precise and responding optimally to new information. So that's one of the paradoxes that confuses people. So statisticians develop the theory of a random walk. Let me define it for you. A random walk occurs when you have a variable x at time t is equal to x at time t minus 1 plus epsilon sub t, where epsilon sub t is noise, unforecastable noise. Okay? So this is the random walk. X would be here, how far the person is from the lamppost. Here's 0, let's say. Okay? And x is the distance from the lamppost. So at every time interval, we have x sub t, which is how far the drunk has deviated from the lamppost. This is the random step. This is where the drunk was last period, and this is where the drunk is this period. Okay, so that's a random walk. And in the heyday of efficient markets theory, people said that efficient markets is working very well. In other words, the random walk hypothesis describes stock prices very well. So let me go to my spreadsheet, which I have up here. I'll put this spreadsheet up on the web for you. What I have here is shown, there's two lines shown. One is a blue line, which is the blue line is the actual Standard & Poor's composite stock price index going back to 1871. This is a series that it got this series from Standard & Poor's. And I emphasize it a lot in my book. It's a 130-year-long stock price series, monthly, for the United States. It's now called the S&P 500 because starting in 1957, Standard & Poor's, well, they kind of reorganized the index, and they kept it at 500 stocks. So this is the second most famous stock price index after the Dow Jones Industrial Average. But I think it's better than the Dow Jones Industrial Average because the Dow has only 30 stocks, and this has 500. It's representative of most of the market. So that's history. That blue line there is history, OK? Now, what I did on Excel is I generated a random walk, because there's a random number generator on Excel. And I used the random number generator and plugged it into this formula, x sub t equals x sub t minus 1 plus epsilon sub t. And that pink line is a true random walk. It was generated by a random number generator. Okay, and the point here is, don't they look kind of similar? Okay, when people look at stock prices, they get it's an illusion. This is a psychological illusion. They get the sense that there are bull markets when the market is going up, and there are bear markets when the market is going down. There must be some force pushing it up for a while. So you can see, for example, I'm looking at the blue line. There was a bull market in the 1920s, a famous bull market, right? The Roaring 20s. And so you would say, that can't just be a random walk. It was just going up all the time. And then this is the 1929 peak. And look, there's the crash from 1929 to 1932. Big crash. That can't be a random walk, right? That's what people think. They have this intuitive idea. But if you look, this random walk seems to do the same thing. The pink line there's a nice bull market there, and there's another crash. Look at this whole period here. This was really strong. And then it leveled out. We had bad, in fact, they kind of look similar, don't they? This is pure chance, because that random walk that I generated was pure random walk. But there's the actual bull market of the 1950s and 60s. And my random walk comes out pretty close to that. So the random walk theorist says that people are operating under illusions, that there really is no trends or there's no way to predict the market. It is just completely unforecastable. Now, incidentally, nice thing about Excel is I can generate a new random walk for you on the spot by pressing F9, if you know that key on Excel. So I will press F9. And history is going to stay the same. The blue line is going to stay the same. But the pink line is going to change. And I can generate whole 100-year history, pseudo-histories, with the press of a button. So let's see if this works. Okay, we just got, what is that saying? Okay, I put an upward trend to the random walk there. Because I think there's an uptrend to the stock market. So it's a little different than this. I just added a time trend. Otherwise, it's exactly that random walk formula that I used. Okay, that looks pretty much like history too, except we would be in a bear market for quite a while, right? We have quite a bear market in the pink line. But I can correct that by pressing F9 again. Oops. Well, this is bad luck. The stock market crashed in the, it went off the chart here. That's bad luck. But I can try again. Oh, look at that one. Isn't that a beauty? It really looks like the market we've had. So I can just go, it's just amazing how fast this thing generates. Look at that. Whoops, I should stop. Tell me when one looks really interesting. Well, that's an interesting one. If that was the history that we randomly had, Jeremy Siegel would write not just stocks for the long run. He would be jubilant at the returns on stocks. He would say, for 100 years, this is 130 years, for 130 years, stocks have wonderfully outperformed the market, outperformed other things. That is looking pretty good, isn't it? And I just press the button and get, I'm not getting many bad ones. That's probably have an uptrend in it. But they all look similar, right? Now, the other thing I wanted to talk about was another thing called AR1, which is a different story. And the AR1, this is the random walk here. The other idea is that, let me do it intuitively first. I'm going to tie an elastic cord around the ankle of the drunk, okay? And tie it to the lamp pole. And, okay, can you see my elastic cord? It's very loose at the beginning, so the drunk can move freely. But if it starts to get stretchy, when the drunk makes it all the way over here, then it's really hard it's pulling the drunk back, okay? So that means it biases the drunk back towards the starting point. And that's called a AR1, or first order autoregressive. Model. And so that means that there's something, the random walk has no center, it just has a starting point. It doesn't tend to go back anywhere. But here we have a center. What'll I call that? I'll call it X bar is this point here, not necessarily zero. And it says that X sub t minus X bar is equal to X bar plus rho times X sub t minus 1 minus X bar plus epsilon sub t. Okay, and rho lies between minus 1 and plus 1. Usually it's positive. All right, you see that? So rho is, the smaller rho is, the tighter the elastic cord is. So, It gets pulled back by 1 minus rho of the way back to the X bar in every time period. But then there's new noise that adds on to it. If there were no new noise, then the drunk would just be gradually pulled back. But there's new noise, and so the drunk is not so the drunk is not so predictable. Okay, so that's another model of the stock market, but it's not an efficient markets model. The random walk is efficient markets model that says you can't profit by trading because you just cannot predict the change in price. But with the first order autoregressive, you can predict the change of price, at least a little bit. When what goes up comes down. If the drunk is over here, it tends to get pulled back here. If the drunk is over here, it tends to get pulled back up. And so that's the random walk model. So I programmed into this program an AR1. So I go down here and click on it. That looks very different, doesn't it? Maybe I didn't get the parameters exactly right. But let me just hit F9. I'll get it so it looks better. Well, it looks a little different, right? You see a difference in this? That's because I chose rho equals 0.95 for that diagram. So it's kind of getting tugged back to the trend. But sometimes it's hard to tell. I mean, I thought, can you tell the difference between a random walk and an AR1? It seems to be coming back faster. So that looks different. Well, with rho equal 0.95, I guess it does look noticeably different, right? Because it's coming back pretty fast. I have 130 years observations, and it's coming back 5% of the way every year. So in 5 years, it's 25% of the way back. I've got the cord too tight. So it's not fooling you, right? You can see a difference between this AR1 and the true stock market. So this is revealing some truth to the efficient markets hypothesis. But what if I made rho equal 0.99? Then I think I should have done that instead of 0.95. Then it gets harder for you to see the difference. And if I make rho equals 1 in this, what happens if I plug rho equals 1 into this expression? It comes back to the random walk, right? Because the x bars drop out. Because you've got 1 times x bar, and you've got minus x bar over here. So they drop out of the equation, and you come back up here. So a random walk is just a AR1 with a coefficient of rho of 1. Now, the point is, then, that we can easily see that the stock market is not strongly mean reverting or trend reverting, but it may be somewhat trend reverting. It's very hard to tell whether its rho is 1 or 0.99. And so that's the point of my little analysis here of random walk versus AR1. So, okay. Now, the homework, the problem set that you will have next time. Now, you still haven't turned in your second problem set, but I want to work ahead now to the third one. What I want you to do is to try forecasting the stock market. And so let me show you what I did here. And I want you to do something. You could use this spreadsheet, but I'm also encouraging you to find your own data. So here is my spreadsheet, which has stock prices back to 1871. Can you see all this? I have this on my website all the time. I've had it on my website, how long? It must be 20 years. I've been just, I give it away. because I'm the person who updates S&P data for 1871 to the present. And S&P, I now have a relationship with S&P because they're publishing our indices, but they still don't provide updates of this 100-year-long series. So here it is, all the way back to 1871. So what do I have here? I have in column 1 is the Standard & Poor Composite Stock Price Index, today called the S&P 500. Okay, this is the dividend on the S&P 500. They've been paying a dividend consistently. It's never missed a year. Maybe some companies have missed a year, like Berkshire Hathaway or Microsoft. But the whole aggregate has never missed a year. This is the earnings reported on the companies. All right, it's all per share. All right, so this is per share earnings. And I have here the consumer price index in this column. Okay. And then and I've got long-term interest rate. And I converted it to a real price by dividing by the consumer price index. And this is the change in the real price. Okay, it's between this year and the next year. And so what I wanted to do is, this is your homework assignment, and maybe I'll come back to this, or maybe your TAs will come back to it as well. I want you to try to forecast the stock market, okay? But remember what you're trying to forecast. You're trying to forecast epsilon. You're not trying to forecast x. We already know x is easy to forecast. It's close to what it was last period. The hard thing is to predict where the next change will be. So I had to generate a column of data here which is the change in the price. So you see up here, it says J10 minus J9 is the change in the price. That's what you want to try to forecast. All right? And so I created this column going all the way back to 1871, showing for each year how much the S&P composite index in real terms changed. I did it in logs. I took the change in the log of real price. So that's like essentially the percentage change. That is going to be hard to forecast. Obviously, it's going to be hard to forecast because there's some truth to the efficient markets hypothesis. If that were easy to forecast, you could have been rich over this period. Somebody could have been rich. It can't be that easy. Nonetheless, the problem set for you is to try to do that, to try to forecast it. So what you have to do is go to regression analysis. And you don't have to use Excel, but that's just what I'm suggesting here because that's the easiest thing. So to run a regression, you go up to Tools. Let me see. Data Analysis. I can't even find it. It's down here. And then you go to Regression. I guess I have to say OK. And then it asks you to fill in your X range and your Y range. So the X variable is the, remember the regression model is, Y equals alpha plus beta X plus some error term, epsilon or U. I'll call it U so we don't get mixed up, all right? So it's asking you to say where your y variable is. And I've got that my y variable is in column k, right? Because that's what I've generated. That's the change where is k? Oh, wait. I've lost it. I can't. It's not column k. It's, I don't know if I can do it. It's, I'm trying to find it here. It's column I, isn't it? I have to move this. That's the change in price. And then the X variable, I can pick some variable to forecast. What I did is I just took column A, which is time. It's just the year. And I ran the regression since 1950. And I got the results here, right here. Oops, let's get rid of it. I'm just going to show you the results from what regression I ran. That's how Excel prints out regression results. The alpha, which is the intercept, is shown here. So the intercept was 0.05. The beta is the coefficient of the variable is minus 2 times 10 to the minus 5th power. You can see now I've struck out. It doesn't like time as a forecaster. It's a very small coefficient. The t statistic is a measure of statistical significance. And the t statistic should probably be over 2 for statistical significance. And I've got insignificant t statistics for both alpha and for beta. So the r squared is a measure of what fraction of the dependent variable y's variance I have predicted. And so it comes out with a fraction of 0.000147. All right? This is not a success. This is not a get-rich-quick story because I'm explaining 1/10,000th of the variance of the stock market. So I struck out. Okay? I wasn't really trying that hard. I just regressed the returns on time. So the problem set for you is to think about seeing if you can forecast the market. You don't have to use my data set. You can use others. You can go online and find them. For example, finance.yahoo.com has a lot of indexes. But you can find them on other sites. So if you find some other data, and you can try to see if you can beat me, I'm not setting up a very high standard for success. If it were this bad, efficient markets, well, this looks good for efficient markets theory. So what I thought you might do for the problem set is to try to think creatively about how to forecast the market. And let me say this. I'm going to have to go continue with my doubts about efficient markets in another lecture. But I think that the story has a good element of truth to it. It has to be hard to beat the market, but it's oversold as well, especially in academic circles. I think us professors who are poor it's kind of a wishful thinking bias. We're not making much money, and you can't anyway. We kind of tend to overstate efficient markets hypothesis. On the other hand, relative to your expectations as naive young people, it may be a good thing to do to overstate efficient markets hypothesis. There seems to be a life cycle effect where young people think, I can surely predict the market, and then they get beaten down. Brad Barber and Terry O'Dean, who are professors at UC, at different campuses of California, teamed up with some economists from Taiwan and looked at data of, they got really good data from Taiwan about day traders and their actual returns. That day traders are people who trade every day in the markets. And they found that there was a really predictable pattern. The young people, they start in as a day trader, and they quickly lose everything. And they lose badly because they're trading too much and they really can't predict the market. There's like 1% of them, though, who seem like they can actually beat the market. This looks like really good for efficient markets. But they found that there are some Taiwanese people who know how to beat the market. 1% survives and stays in. So is that contrary to efficient markets? Well, it does seem contrary because they found a small number of people did find some forecasting rule and succeeded. On the other hand, hardly any of them got really rich. And so it's very rare. Warren Buffett is an extremely rare outcome. And so I guess when I talk about efficient markets, I want to help prevent you from suffering under any delusions about your forecasting ability. But I don't mean that Warren Buffett can't do it, or that you can't do it if you develop yourself into a Warren Buffett. So the problem set number three asks you to think creatively about how you would forecast the market and to take a stab at it by running a regression. And I expect you all to fail, or almost all of you to fail. Your grade will not depend on your success in forecast. It may even depend inversely, because if you show a big success in forecasting, your teaching assistant will look at it very carefully and try to find some mistake you made, because if you do succeed, it's probably a mistake. On the other hand, I don't want to tell you that you can't, because as I said, we're going to come back to this, but I have doubts about efficient markets, and I think that you just might be able to do it if you're smart about it.